Okay, so our topic tonight is the beginning of the British administration in Palestine. And we're going to discuss the years 1918 through 1920, maybe 1921. The Balfour Declaration was issued on November 2nd, 1917, and this was much to the chagrin of the military establishment in the Middle East. They regarded the politicians' commitment to Zionism as a distraction and a burden that they didn't really want. So General Edmund Allenby, who conquers the land of Israel, is not a Zionist, is not necessarily hostile to the Jews, but will see any obligation that Britain undertakes to give special treatment to the Jews as one which is just a burden, a nuisance for him. So the conquest of Jerusalem takes place on December 11th, 1917, and the mayor of Jerusalem tries to formally surrender to the British authorities, only to find that every time he encounters British soldiers, they refuse to accept the surrender, because they're not high enough ranking officers to formally accept the surrender. So over the course of a weekend, he surrendered seven times, or at least tried to.
Who was the mayor?
The mayor was a member of the Husseini family.
Oh, yeah.
And the British are coming in. They kind of get bogged down just north of Jerusalem and don't conquer the rest of the country until late in the year 1918, so there's a bit of a time lag. But by the late 1918, when the war ends in the east on October 31st, 1918, all of the land of Israel is in British hands. When I say all the land of Israel, that's a very ambiguous term, because what are the borders of the land of Israel? It's hard to say. To the east, there's the Jordanian desert. Well, the British are nominally in control of that as well. And to the north, there is Syria, or you might want to call it Lebanon. And the French are going to end up controlling those regions, but the exact border demarcating French control versus British control is still uncertain and to be determined by diplomatic negotiations over the next 4 or 5 years. Actually, in the long run, to the detriment of Zionist interests, because the border ends up moving further south and west, taking away from potential Jewish control what is today southern Lebanon, the Golan Heights, and southern Syria. Okay. Well, the Occupied Enemy Territory Administration, the OETA, runs the country from early December 1917 until such time as a civilian administration is able to take over. But a civilian administration can only take over once there are treaties that formally bring to an end the hostilities. It's going to take 2.5 years for that to happen. It's not until June of 1920 that the civilian administration takes over in Eretz Yisrael. During that time, The Zionists have to deal with a disgruntled British military, which is staffed mostly by pro-Arab people who had a track record of working with Arabs during the war and did not necessarily understand why European white people were in the Middle East. If you didn't know about Zionism ahead of time, why would Russian Jews or Lithuanian Jews or Polish Jews be in a 100-degree climate in the Middle East? You wouldn't understand it. So there was a certain disconnect there. Okay. Well, because Chaim Weizmann and the Zionists abroad had friends in high places, they were able to secure for themselves the right to travel to Eretz Yisrael and to offer advice, sometimes be a petty irritant to the military administration in the land of Israel. This was known as the Zionist Commission. So the Zionist Commission was Weizmann and a few other guys from England, France, Italy, and Russia, eventually also America. So basically all the winning countries of the war were allowed to send representatives that were part of this Zionist Commission. What was the relationship of this group to the World Zionist Organization? None. Chaim Weizmann becomes the president of the World Zionist Organization in 1921 at the next Zionist Congress. But in 1918, he's just the leader of the British wing of Zionism, and because of his power and his access, he's able to take on this leadership role. Some say he became a dictatorial tyrant that had a big ego. All right? No, he deserved to have a big ego because he got things done. Well, this Zionist commission, when they got to the land of Israel, what were they doing? What were they fighting for? One of the most important things they fought for was the recognition of Hebrew language as a, I wouldn't call it an official language of Palestine, but one that is on the signage. That if it was only going to be English and Arabic, what impression does that give? That the indigenous people are Arab, and the overlords are British. And where do the Jews fit in? They don't. So by insisting upon Hebrew on the signage, it means that the Jews are part of this equation. Now, by the way, the Jewish attitude towards the native population is a very interesting one. In colonial matters, British colonial matters, what is there typically? There are the indigenous peoples who are lowly and to be treated with disdain, primitive, can't govern themselves. And then there are the British who show up and teach them all the things about Western civilization and how to govern themselves. So the Arabs are clearly at the bottom. And the British are clearly at the top. But what are the Jews? On the one hand, Jews were desperate to be regarded as an indigenous people and therefore with rights to Eretz Yisrael, but they did not want to be regarded as on the same level of indigenousness as the Arabs. So we're part of Eretz Yisrael because it's historically our land and we were here thousands of years ago, but we're not primitive savages like them. So it was a very odd trying to be on two sides of the fence at the same time, of being indigenous but not really indigenous. Okay. Now another thing that the Zionist Commission had to deal with was the Chalukah, charity. That the old Yishuv, and much of the new Yishuv, prior to World War I, was relying upon outside financial help. Certainly those people who didn't work for a living and who were clearly charity cases, as was this so in the old Yishuv, but even the new Yishuv, where they were relying upon the Rothschilds or the Maurice de Hirsch or just philanthropic dollars from the Zionist organization, all these people during the war were in dire straits. Money was funneled through Neely to get into the country during 1917. A lot of people could not support themselves. And the Zionist Commission was getting requests here and there from everyone, please give me money for this, give me money for that, as though they were, grandpa money bags. But Weizmann did not have that much cash at his disposal. And if anything, he wanted to undo this system and make people have to fend for themselves. So you don't want to be a miser and cause human suffering. On the other hand, you don't want to perpetuate a bad system. One of the things he wanted to spend money on, but was unsuccessful, was to buy the Kotel, to buy the Western Wall. This is a forgotten story in Zionist history. Okay, so...
This was
Weizmann? Weizmann, yes.
Such a religious man.
For nationalist purposes.
It was a symbol.
Symbolic value. The Kotel had symbolic value. So from whom would you buy it? Well, first of all, from the Muslim authorities who controlled the wall proper, and then to buy from the private homeowners who lived in the Maghreb quarter, and then to demolish the quarter and create a plaza. So what was actually done in 1967, in the week or two after the Six-Day War, was already to a certain degree contemplated in 1919, but not put into effect because the Waqf didn't want to sell, and the price wasn't right. basically, it wasn't going to happen. There was intent, but it was a bit of a pie-in-the-sky idea. Okay. Well, what does happen in 1918 is the laying of the cornerstone of Hebrew University. This is an important step forward for, not for political Zionism necessarily, but for cultural Zionism. There had already been talk of a Jewish university in Eretz Yisrael as early as the Katowice Conference of the Chov Beit Zion in 1884. And certainly from the beginnings of the Zionist Congresses in 1897, there was talk of a university. The spiritual wing of Zionism, the Achad Ha'am crowd, the Bialik crowd, they very much regarded an educational institution as the center of Jewish revival in the Holy Land, that the Hebrew University would be the core of everything. They used to say about Gershom Shalom, this is like a 1 minute aside, they used to say about Gershom Shalom that he thought that Israel is the center of the world, and Jerusalem is the center of Israel, and Hebrew University is the center of Jerusalem, and Gershom Shalom is the center of Hebrew University. And the scary thing is, he's right. That's what they used to say. So, but for that crowd, this was a major accomplishment. So the British were not so sure they wanted to allow this ceremony to take place. They kind of reluctantly allowed for it, and there were 12 stones, 12 cornerstones that were laid down to recognize the 12 tribes of Israel. Weizmann, never worried about the Zionist budget, was hoping that the stonemasons would give it for free. They sent them a big bill afterwards. They were Jewish. Okay. Okay. Then, later in 1918, Weizmann goes to the desert to meet Faisal, the son of Sharif Hussein of Mecca. So Faisal is a prominent figure in Arab politics, a leader of the Arab rebellion, and has his eye on the prize of being the king of an Arab state. He had been involved in correspondence with the British already for a few years. So, what happens is, Weizmann travels to Aqaba, and then gets in a car, and goes into the desert. The car breaks down, they take a mule, the mule breaks down, they take a horse, the horse breaks down, they have to walk. They finally get to the middle of nowhere.
Oh, wow.
And here is Prince Faisal. And what happens? The meeting occurs, Weizmann tries to make peace with him. It seems to go reasonably well. They both speak French. Faisal doesn't really speak English. So there's communication, but there's maybe a certain ambiguity to the communication. They agree to meet again. They do meet again in Paris in 1919, a few months later, during the Paris peace negotiations. And T.E. Lawrence prepares a document in English in which Faisal agrees to the Jewish National Home in Eretz Yisrael.
Wow.
T. Lawrence, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
It is claimed that Faisal didn't know what he was signing.
Oh, wow.
And presumably he didn't know what he was signing. But on the original piece of paper, next to his signature in Arabic, there was a caveat written in Arabic that Palestine is excluded from any of the above discussion. So, like, the caveat at the bottom negated the whole purpose of the document. Why was this document procured in the first place? Because the Zionists wanted people to think that there wasn't going to be Arab objection to Jewish nationalism in the Middle East. Of course, this is a charade, but sometimes you need to use a scam like this for the right cause. He loved Arabs, but he was not hostile to Zionism.
He wasn't.
Not really. In fact, he was a big fan of Aaron Aronson, and he facilitated this scam in favor of Weizmann. So he was a bizarre character, very bizarre character. And I and in in some historiography and in the popular imagination, he gets a bum rap as being anti the Jews, but he really wasn't. Okay. So.
Maybe you saw the movie Lawrence of Arabia?
Yeah. Many years ago, yeah.
No, but did that project him as being anti
Jewish? I don't remember. I don't remember.
O'Toole, who played him, was also bizarre. In real life.
I would imagine so. Well, so the Paris Peace Conference is a major success for the Zionists in that they are able to guarantee that the British control Eretz Israel and they keep out the French. The French were seen as hostile to Zionism, and so long as the British would retain control, the movement can progress nicely, that the overthrow of the Turks would have been for a positive development and a sustained positive development. Also, the Balfour Declaration, which was controversial in its own time, a year and a half earlier, was not repudiated by those who had at first espoused it, and in fact would remain an important component in the settling of the affairs of the Middle East, which means that the Balfour Declaration, or the substance of it, the favoring of a Jewish national home secured by the British, would be included in whatever mandate the British are going to get for Palestine, which happens a year later at the San Remo Conference in 1920, and again when the League of Nations approves the mandate in 1922. So at Paris in 1919, Zionism is flexing its muscle, is on the up, on the ascendancy, and is quite successful. By the way, there are other Jews at the Paris Peace Conference who are anti-Zionist, who don't want to see Jewish nationalism recognized as such.
Where were they from?
Mostly from America. Okay, so German Jews in America who want to see Judaism as a religion recognized only as a religion, and not a racial group or a national group, and at most they want minority rights in the Eastern European countries, that people should be protected and not be persecuted.
Solomon Schechter didn't play a role.
Solomon Schechter was dead. He died in 1915.
Why didn't they like the French? What was the French's problem?
The French were not interested in facilitating Jewish nationalism. The French had their own interests, which were pro-Christian, to the north in Lebanon and Syria. Okay, so things do not stay calm. If 1919 was a year of turmoil in Eastern Europe, which it was, thousands of people getting killed, but was a year of relative calm in Eretz Yisrael, then 1920 will change things. On March 1st, there is the Battle of Tel Chai. The Battle of Tel Chai maybe didn't even need to happen. There might have been miscommunication between Arabs and Jews, which led to a sort of an unprovoked and unnecessary fight. The point is, in the Upper Galilee, there were only about 100 Jews. There were very few Jews in the Upper Galilee. In the Lower Galilee, there were plenty of Jews. Near the Kinneret, there were plenty of Jews. There was the Dagan area, the Kivutzat Kinneret, but all the way up where today is Metula, almost nobody, 100 Jews, that's it. One outpost was Tel Chai, another was Kfar Giladi, which was about a kilometer and a half away. Today it's all called Kfar Giladi. And there was ongoing skirmishes in the Franco-Syrian war. There was a war going on in Syria between forces of Faisal, who had proclaimed himself king of the Arab state, and the French military administration. Ultimately, the French win, and Faisal is not the king of Syria or of the Arab state. He gets booted out. He spends a couple of months in Haifa and then becomes king of Iraq. Okay, but for our purposes, there's fighting going on, and Arab forces barge into Tel Chai and want to do an investigation to see if there are any French fighters there. One thing leads to another, and shots are fired. And reinforcements are called from Kfar Giladi, where Yosef Trumpeldor is located, and he and about 10 of his buddies come to the defense of their buddies at Tel Chai, and it doesn't end well. 8 are killed, including Yosef Trumpeldor. famously, his dying words were?
Tov lamut be'aretzenu.
Okay. Ein davar, tov lamut be'aretzenu. It's nothing. It's good to die for one's country. Did he really say that? We don't know. It's one of these things where I wasn't there. I couldn't tell you. But the legend has it. He said, tov lamut be'aretzenu. And he became a mythic folk hero at a time when Zionism needed a folk hero. Because things are going to get very tough in the months that follow. And you need to... the idea of martyrdom for the country was a new concept, but a necessary concept. Okay. Well, this was a chaotic time. As I said, the Arab state had been proclaimed by Faisal. The French are fighting him. The British are trying to hold on to Palestine. The Jews want to come in large numbers. The Arabs don't want the Jews to come in. A lot of stuff, moving parts here. And then the Nebi Musa riots. April 4th, 1920. What happens? Nebi Musa is an annual holiday, a Muslim holiday, in honor of Moses. Moses, Musa. Where's Moses buried? Okay, good, good, good. Good gesagt. He's buried in Har Nevo. Where is Har Nevo? What side of the river is that on? East or west?
East,
good. In Islam, he's buried on the west side of the river. Why? Because they don't know what they're talking about. Okay, all right, so there's a place called Nebi Musa, which is not far from Ma'ale Adumim, actually closer to Yericho, where they claim Moses is buried. And every year for like 700 years, from the 1200s and onward, there was an annual procession, the Nebi Musa procession. It would start in Jerusalem and go towards the wilderness, to the yonder. Huh? No, Muslims. It was around Easter time. And this year, that year was Pesach, Easter, and Nebi Musa all combined. So everybody's religiously motivated at that time. And the Jews anticipated that a pogrom was coming. They could sense something wasn't right. Ronald Storrs, who was the military governor of Jerusalem, did not take the necessary precautions. He had an insufficient number of police force, and the military was not anywhere nearby. So they were relying upon poorly trained and not very motivated police, some of whom were themselves Arab, to restrain a wild crowd. 60,000 Arabs gathered in what is today Kikar Tzahal, which is, if you know your Jerusalem, you know the traffic light where the light rail turns northbound? So Rehov Yafo, Jaffa Road towards the old city walls, and then it turns to the left? That's was then the city square, the city center. The Iriyaz is located there now. Well, thousands and thousands of people here, and nobody knows what precipitated the riot. Was it somebody threw a punch? Somebody made an ethnic slur? You never know what the first thing was. But the crowd goes wild, and they start attacking inside the old city, outside the old city, but especially inside. And inside the old city, bear in mind the following. Even if there's a police station 100 yards away or 100 feet away, it guarantees nobody's safety, because there are twisty, turny, windy roads and alleyways and staircases up and down. The police station could be right there, but they don't see you if you're around a bend, even 50 feet away.
Through an IQ test.
Oh, exactly. So people are in danger. What's the telltale sign of an Arab riot? Feathers. Oh, they take the blankets and pillows of their victim and stab them, okay, and the feathers go all over the place. That's when you know that a riot, and a murderous one at that, is underway. Okay.
So who were they rioting with, the Jews?
Jews. So in the end, five Jews are killed. Five Jews and four Arabs are killed. And dozens are wounded, several critically. The insufficient British response was blamed on Ronald Storrs, the governor, and he didn't have a good answer for, you know, why he was caught off guard. He simply was arrogant and thought that he could control the situation with a limited force and save money by not having to have a robust police presence. But he messed up. Menachem Osishkin, the Zionist leader on the ground in Israel, referred to it as a pogrom. And Storrs said, what do you mean? It's not a pogrom. A pogrom implies government complicity, like in Russia. To which Osishkin told him, you're an expert in administration, and I'm an expert in pogroms. This was a pogrom. There was a question whether or not there really was British complicity. There's some anecdotal evidence that people knew something was coming. There were certain Christian Arab milkmen and other municipal service people who told Jews in Mea Shearim, pay us now, you cannot get stuff on credit because we won't be coming back here. And this is a day or two before the riot, indicating that they knew relations between the religious communities was going to be frayed and there'd be no commercial interaction between them going forward. So that's an example, but not the only example, of people thinking, you know, in hindsight, I had a nugget of information that could have led me to believe disaster was coming. Okay. What about Jewish self-defense? Jewish self-defense. So there had been, ever since 1907, various organizations that were to defend Jews. It began with Bar Giora, it continued with HaShomer and HaMagen, plus there was Neely during the war as a spy organization. So, but HaShomer was the main one, and then there was the Jewish Legion. The Jewish Legion, which still had several hundred Jews under the British arms, could have been used to defend the Jewish population during riots. But that's dafka what the British didn't want to have happen. They didn't want to have Jews in a British uniform serving in a capacity of defending a Jewish community against the local population. The British couldn't tolerate that. So the idea that Jabotinsky had 3 years earlier of why do we need a Jewish legion, precisely to serve as the formal and official defense mechanism for our people, that didn't come to pass. Didn't come to pass. Instead, what did Jabotinsky do? He found a few hundred decommissioned Jewish legionnaires and started to train them in defense, self-defense. It was mostly calisthenics and use of sticks because they weren't allowed to own guns. And he did it in the open, in the days and weeks before the riot, knowing that something bad was going to happen. Why did he do it out in the open? So this leads to an interesting machlokus, a disagreement between Jabotinsky and the labor Zionist crowd. The labor Zionist crowd, they did not trust the British at all. And they believed early on for the need to have an underground, a clandestine paramilitary organization that would eventually become the Haganah. The Haganah. Jabotinsky believed, no, Zionism should never be clandestine. It should be above ground, out in the open. The British made promises, let them keep those promises. They don't keep the promises, we'll defend ourselves, but like honorable people, out in the open. No clandestine military organization. So that's why he had his guys training in the presence of all the onlookers. It turned out that he was wrong, and labor was right. That you needed to have a Haganah, and precisely because there was no Haganah in 1920, and again it wasn't so formed in 1921, that Jews died in large numbers during riots. And then in 1929, wherever the Haganah was not carefully deployed, Jews died again. Okay.
Where was the Palmach?
The Palmach doesn't come into existence until later, until the World War II.
Did they have guns?
Huh?
The Haganah had guns?
They did. Yeah, whether they legally had guns is a separate matter.
That's what the Hebron was.
So in 1929, they were not represented in Hebron, that's why people got killed. Okay. So Jabotinsky had some weapons, and his he came with Pinchas Rutenberg to Ronald Storrs to beg for British protection for the Jewish community. He had a pistol on him and handed the pistol over to Storrs. Technically, it was illegal for him to have that pistol, and he could have gotten arrested for it, but he wasn't arrested yet. Then, when his home was searched during the riots, or as the riots were coming to an end, they found three rifles and two more pistols. He was not home, so he wasn't arrested. But 19 of his collaborators were arrested. He came with his lawyer to the municipal building and said, "How come you didn't arrest me too?" So they arrested him. In other words, he wanted to be arrested. Like, you know, like Avi Weiss used to get arrested all the time with the Soviet Jewry, okay? He wanted to be arrested. But then he was released. But then he was arrested again. And then he was sent to Egypt. And then he was brought back from Egypt. And then he was sentenced to 15 years in jail. 15 years in jail? That's crazy. Who else was arrested? The young fella, Amin Husseini, who would go on to become the Mufti. Also, Arif Arif, who would go on to become the mayor of Jerusalem and was a Palestinian nationalist leader. So there were Jews arrested and there were Arabs arrested. And they were given stiff sentences. But the Jews got it worse. Eventually, all these sentences would be commuted to much less time. Jabotinsky would be to a year. Then he would be released under Herbert Samuel. He'd be given amnesty completely. But in its moment, he was a martyr and a hero for suffering for the cause of Jewish defense. Okay. Now, by the way, there had been an earlier dispute on matters of Jewish defense between Ben-Gurion and Jabotinsky. Now, I haven't mentioned David Ben-Gurion once so far. It's already December 31st, and we've been learning this for a few months now, and I have not mentioned David Ben-Gurion yet. Why? Because he comes as a young fellow, you know, he's not a player yet on the scene. Well, now he's a player. He's a low-level hack in the labor branch of Zionism.
He spent the war in New York.
But he comes back to Eretz Yisrael in 1919, and he establishes the Achdut HaAvodah party, the precursor to the Mapai. And he, when it came to Tel Chai, was of the opinion, don't withdraw. Fight to the last man at any Jewish settlement. Jabotinsky, the right-winger, supposedly the militarist, was the one who said, no, withdraw. You can't hold it. There's nobody there. Don't be a fool. So the right-winger is the more moderate position, and Ben-Gurion is the extreme position. This would repeat itself when, in 1948, when Ben-Gurion was of the view, don't give up on any settlement. Even if it's an isolated outpost, you hold on to it at all costs. Which sometimes led to disaster, but that was his viewpoint. Okay. Now, after the Arab riots of 1920, the San Remo conference happened later that month, late April, and it reiterated the Balfour Declaration's notion of a Jewish national home, which meant that now it was time for a civilian administration to take over from the military. But who was going to be the leader of this civilian administration? The answer is a Jew. A Jew by the name of Herbert Samuel. Why a Jew and not a Goy? Is it a good thing or a bad thing for it to be a Jew? What do you think?
Expected to be loyal to the British.
Well, it wasn't going to be an Arab. It was going to be a British person. But a British person could be a Protestant, could be maybe even a Catholic, it could be a Jew. So among the British Foreign Service class, they happened to choose a Jew. Why?
American?
Herbert Samuel.
British. British. So the answer seems to be that the British were under the impression if they didn't pick a Jew, the Zionists would complain that you're not satisfying your promises that you made in the Balfour Declaration and in the various other agreements and treaties that concluded the war. But if it was a Jew, even if that Jew were to bend over backwards to placate the Arabs, the Jews couldn't complain because, after all, it was a Jew. That's the logic. And it worked perfectly, in the sense that Herbert Samuel is afraid, whenever he has to make a tough decision, that the Arabs will regard him favoring Zionist interests as being the deck stacked against them and in favor of the Jews. So whenever he has to make a tough decision, he's leaning towards the Arab position out of a desire for not impartiality, but to avoid the accusation of favoritism. In the end, you could argue, well, so it worked against Jewish interests to have a Jew in office. They would have been better off with a goy. All right. What kind of a Jew was Herbert Samuel? He was a Jew from a traditional family, but who in his college years became an atheist and was not interested in religion whatsoever, but became a devotee of Zionism early in World War I. And in fact, in 1914 and 15, he wrote a draft memorandum favoring British conquest of the land of Israel for the sake of advancing Zionist interests. So he was an open and declared Zionist, aside from being a good British Jew. When he got to the land of Israel in 1920, the Arabs were clearly not happy, not happy in the least. They're not happy about Balfour. They're not happy that Jewish immigration is being unchecked. They're not happy about land purchases by the Jews. They're not happy about the absence of representative democracy, which would benefit them. Okay? And they're especially not happy that a Jew is running the country. But Herbert Samuel does whatever he can to placate everybody and to make himself into a respected figure. He ends up serving 5 years till 1925, and his term was actually quite successful when it comes to establishing a civilian administration, municipal services, countrywide services, building of roads, building of schools, hospitals, etc. Palestine was a backwater, was a horrible place in 1919, having been devastated by the war. By 1925, it's on its way to being a decent outpost in the British Empire.
So they brought British builders in to make the hospitals?
No. They brought Jews, did a lot of the construction on the roads, and Arabs did construction too.
But the plans... Oh,
so a lot of the plans were done by British civil servants, but also some done by Jews. Including the electrical works was done by Jews.
Really?
Yeah, by Rutenberg, Pinchas Rutenberg. Okay, so when Samuel comes to Jerusalem, he lives in the government house. Where was the government house? So it's not what you think a government house is. What is today the Jewish neighborhood of Armon HaNatziv, so-called government house, is south of the old city. It was in the no man's land between 48 and 67. That was famously government house. However, that was in the 30s and 40s. In the 1920s, the original government house was on the Mount of Olives, Har HaZeitim, at the top, okay, above the cemetery. And on Shabbos Nachamu, what happened? Shabbos Nachamu, 1920, Herbert Samuel walks down the hill through the Lion's Gate into the Jewish quarter to the Churva Synagogue. The Churva Synagogue. And they give him the Haftorah. And he said jokingly afterwards, "My Hebrew was so bad they couldn't tell whether I did Nusach Sfar or Nusach Ashkenaz." And it was good, this way I didn't offend anybody. Okay. Now, Herbert Samuel does a few things. One, he offers clemency and pardon to all the guys who were arrested in the Nebi Musa riots, Jews and Arabs alike. And then he appoints Amin Husseini as Mufti of Jerusalem.
That's a bad move.
So let's examine this for a second. In hindsight, we can say that was a bad move, because from a Jewish perspective, Amin Husseini was the most vicious of the Arab anti-Semites, anti-Jews, and from a British point of view, the guy was a Nazi. So, yes, in hindsight, it was a mistake, but in the moment, was it a mistake? for the Jewish first High Commissioner of British Palestine to appoint that particular young fellow, 26 years old, as the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. So there are many reasons to argue that it was a perfectly rational decision. Amin Husseini's older brother, father, and grandfather had all held the position of Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Okay. Also, there was a clash, historic clash, between the Husseini family and the Nashashibi family. Two leading Jerusalem Palestinian families. And a Nashashibi had just become mayor of Jerusalem, having ousted a Husseini family member. So now, to balance out the equation, they made a Husseini the Grand Mufti. So there were reasons why the kid got the job. It wasn't... Well, he wasn't early on a Nazi, but he would become a Nazi by 1939. Or maybe even earlier. Maybe by 33, I'm sure he was pro-Nazi. Okay. So, in 1921, Winston Churchill comes to the land of Israel. And he is welcomed as a friend, as someone who had expressed pro-Zionist orientation during the war, and were favored... the Jewish national home component of the mandate. But while he's in town, he makes Abdullah, Faisal's brother, the emir of Transjordan. And in the process, takes away Transjordan from the future Jewish national home. This is codified a year later in the 1922 Churchill White Paper, where the boundaries of the Jewish national home are limited to west of the Jordan River. Is that such a terrible thing? Well, probably not. But for the extremists, for the right wingers who would go on to become revisionists after the term is invented in 1925, this is a big sin because they are territorial maximalists. What had been the mainstream Zionist perspective about future borders? So the mainstream Weizmann perspective, which was presented at the Paris Peace Conference, was as far south as Eilat, as far west as the Mediterranean Sea, as far east as the Hejaz Railway, which is 20 miles east of the Jordan River, and as far north as Tyre and Sidon. So we're including now much of the fertile part of what is today Jordan, south Lebanon, the likes of which Israel held after the Lebanon War for the next 20 years, the Golan Heights, and maybe even a little bit beyond that into Syria, and all of British Mandate Palestine. So they don't get all that. All they get is British Mandate Palestine. Well, eventually much less. But is anyone crying tears over this? Not really. It's all an abstraction. After all, there were no Jews in these other places anyway. The only Jews who were east of the Jordan River were in the Machanaim area where they had the electrical plant. And that got destroyed in the 48 war. Okay. So, the British are able now to say that they kept their promises. How many promises did the British make? They made three promises. To Jews, to Arabs, and to the French. Well, to the French, they kept their promise. You guys can have Syria, Lebanon. And in fact, the border adjustments were in your favor. They kept the promise to the Arabs. You want a state? Hey, Transjordan. And Iraq. And to the Jews? Jewish national home. Palestine. We're going to build it. So, very honest people, these British. They kept all their promises.
Wait a minute. When they gave their promises to the Arabs
right,
were the Sunnis and the Shiites.
Arabs are Arabs. They don't. The British are not interested in drawing nuanced distinctions. And by the way, it's an important point, because today we are accustomed to there being many, many different Arab states, and pretending as though that nationalist motivation in each one of those states is distinct and separate, when 80 years ago, 90 years ago, 100 years ago, that was not the case. there was simply Arab nationalism, if it existed at all. Meaning, if it was no nationalism, it was just tribal, clannish warfare, so fine, nobody has aspirations to run a whole country. But where there was aspiration to run a whole country, it was a united Arab state that encompasses a wide swath of territory, not just a small area.
So they didn't busy themselves with tribal stuff. It was just...
The British? No. No.
Arabs?
Yeah. Okay. Now, in 1921, there was another riot. And this riot actually was much worse than the Jerusalem Nabi Musa riot of 1920. 47 people died, as opposed to 5. That's a big difference. And this one happened, again, we don't know exactly how it started.
What was the breakdown?
48 Arabs died, 47 Jews died. But most of the Arabs were killed by British, not by Jews. So, what happened? It was May Day, May 1st, 1921. And the Palestine Bolshevik Party had a May Day celebration parade.
Big Yom Tov.
But they were not the only ones. The Poale Zion also had a parade. The Poale Zion parade had a permit. The Bolshevik Party didn't have a permit. And they got into a fight on the parade route between the two groups of Jews, the moderate left and the crazy super left. And in the tussle, an Arab got hit. And when an Arab got hit, oh boy, come the knives, the daggers, the guns, everybody's shooting. And it didn't just go to Jaffa. It went to Tel Aviv, went to Petah Tikva. So it spread out to a bunch of different cities in the general area in the vicinity of Tel Aviv. There were many more casualties than had been seen previously, including Yosef Chaim Brenner, the famous writer, one of the leading intellectuals and writers of Palestine Jewry, dead, okay, at the age of 40. So this was a very bad incident, and it proved once again the need for the Jews to defend themselves and not to rely upon British protection. That British protection would not be forthcoming, and if anything, during the worst and most tense moments, the British could be counted upon to strip the Jews of their capacity to fight back by confiscating weaponry. So the British were not being helpful. Okay. Well, enough with the riots and enough with the bloodshed.
Why did they get along? In other words, why did the left and the extreme left come to blows?
Okay, so it happens to be that the Bolshevik Party in Israel, they were non-Zionist.
Right.
These are people who make Aliyah who be out of ostensibly Zionist convictions, but really their true love is the workers' revolution, and some of them go back to the Soviet Union. What happens to them? Who knows? Probably get killed. But there was the Palestine Communist Party all throughout the British Mandate period. It was always a combination of Jews and Arabs, although mostly Jewish. And they were a thorn in the side of the rest of the Yishuv because of their political extremism. Okay, who's coming to Israel this time? That's what I want to spend the next few minutes on.
This is what, 1920?
1919 through 1923 is known as the Third Aliyah. The Third Aliyah had about 40,000 people, maybe 35,000, 40,000, we're not exactly sure. And they came mostly from Russia, secondarily from Poland, and then from Romania and Lithuania. But mostly...
And Golda, American.
And Golda, a good Russian Jew, comes from America, from Milwaukee. So, why do people come at this time? Well, first of all, it must be stated that the Zionist organization didn't want them to come. That sounds pretty shocking.
Yeah.
Don't we always say we want Aliyah, Aliyah, you know, it's the big mitzvah? No. At that time, Zionist organization finances were very bad. They had no money. And the economy was bad in Israel. And so there was no job for the guy off the boat. The worst possible scenario, so the Zionist organization believed, was to have people show up and be disillusioned by horrible economic prospects and leave. essentially show up for 5 seconds and walk away with the impression that this is a failure. This whole enterprise stinks. So they didn't want people coming. And when Herbert Samuel gave them 16,000 certificates in the first year of the civilian administration, they only wanted 1,000. In the end, 10,000 came. Okay, because the people didn't listen to the official leadership. So what was motivating people to come? A few things. Number one, ideology. This was a very ideologically motivated aliyah. More so than the ones that would follow. We'll discuss, maybe next week or the week after, the fourth aliyah. The fourth aliyah was the least ideologically, well, the fourth and fifth aliyahs were not so ideologically motivated. The fourth was the middle class aliyah from Poland, and the fifth was the German Nazi aliyah, okay? Most of whom were not Zionists. The third aliyah, like the second aliyah, was very ideologically driven by socialist beliefs. Not communist necessarily, but socialist. HaChalutz and HaShomer HaTzair were the organizations that were thrusting people out of the diaspora and into the Holy Land. Okay. Secondly, the Bolshevik Revolution chased people out of Russia. People of all sorts, because it was a murderous, brutal thing. Certainly Jews, but all sorts of people wanted to leave Russia and escape. Next, there were minority problems in the successor states. Bear in mind the following. Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and other places come to be as states that didn't previously exist as independent states. And they all had to sign in their constitutions a clause protecting minority rights. Part of Wilson's 14 points, minority rights clauses in all these constitutions. But they were usually observed more in the breach than in practice. Most of these places persecuted their ethnic minorities terribly, including the Jews. So, if you live in a successor state in East Central Europe, and you want to leave, so you'll leave. Where are you going to go? Israel's good, especially if you're a Zionist. Then, America. America is closing its doors. 1917, 1921, 1924, there are pieces of legislation passed by Congress, which very severely and dramatically reduce the number of lawful immigrants. So if you can't go to America, Israel's another good option. Also, economic crisis in Europe. After the war, and especially during the Civil War in Eastern Europe between 1919 and 1921, the economy's terrible. So if you want to have a decent way of life, go elsewhere. Where could you go? Israel. And lastly, the second Aliyah had been a success. So people figured, I could do it too. Remember, nothing breeds success like success. If someone has tried something and it fails, the next person is reluctant to follow suit. But if you had predecessors who went and were able to establish themselves, then you think it's not impossible. So for all the Jews who went to Israel 1904 to 1914 in the Second Aliyah and had relatives back in Europe, and they could tell them, listen, I survived a decade in Eretz Israel, I survived the war in Eretz Israel, we have a place to live. So you're not so reluctant to go. Okay. Well, when Jews get there, and there are no jobs available, so what are you going to do? So one of the options was to join a labor gang, a work gang. Not a chain gang, but essentially a gedud avoda. So a few hundred people would join a gang, and they would go up to the north, to Emek Yisrael, or to the Galil, and they would blast away at the rocks and make roads. Road building was a very important thing. The British wanted roads built to have infrastructure in the country. It's horribly tedious and backbreaking labor. So the Jews will do it. Jews right off the boat. Soleil Bonnet. the construction company is established by the Histadrut, and they employ a bunch of people for the purposes of building roads all over the country. Eventually, these folks will either go to kibbutzim or move to the larger cities. And the growth of Tel Aviv is dramatic during the third Aliyah. I mean, it's even more so in the fourth Aliyah when you had the bourgeois, middle class types. But third Aliyah also, the city grew from essentially nothing because it had been devastated during the war to once again being an up-and-coming young city. Okay. The answer is that the British paid the salaries of not only the civil servants, but the day laborers, the hired help. And when it came to infrastructure and Jews involved in that, they were getting their daily bread, their daily paycheck from the civil administration, which was hiring them to construct these roads.
Did they do that in all their colonies?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay. Now, what do the Arabs want at this point? The Arabs see the Jews are coming in, significant numbers, the demographic balance is changing a little bit. What do they want? They want, number one, representative democracy. Why? Because then they win. They're in the overwhelming majority. They want, two, shut the doors to Jewish immigration. And three, no sale of land to the Jews. So the Zionist organization was careful not to press for sale of land to Jews in 1919-2021 because, number one, they didn't have the money yet to buy. So why burn political capital with the British and annoy the Arabs at a time when it isn't going to happen anyway because you don't have the money? On the issue of immigration, the Zionists also didn't push too hard, so long as the British didn't cut back on the permits. But after every riot, there would be a commission of inquiry by the British government, which would come to the same conclusion, every single time, the same conclusion, that the riots are the result of Arab opposition to continued immigration and land sales to Jews, and that the British administration has not done enough to balance out the competing desires. Of course, there was no way to balance them out. This was an intractable situation, but they stacked up report on top of report, as high as the King David Hotel, how they're not doing their job in balancing out the two sides. Okay.
Why did the Arabs know what that representative...
Okay. Okay, so it's interesting you asked that. There were educated Arabs, especially Christian Arabs, who lived in the larger cities, including Jerusalem and Jaffa, who resented the popular notion among Jews and British that the Arabs were all a bunch of barbarians who were not capable of self-governance. They asserted, these Arab Christians, that there is sufficient civilization here in this country that would allow for the election of representatives, and that maybe with the passage of some time and the building up of courtesy of the British of infrastructure, there really could be an Arab state in Palestine. Yeah? And they were offended when Faisal, who, remember, is coming from the Arabian Peninsula, so-called signs a deal with Weizmann that gives away Palestine to the Jews. The Christian Arabs in Jerusalem and Jaffa and Nazareth say to themselves, who gave some Arabian nobody the right to sell away my political future to the Jews? We want our own political future. And what's the British response? You're not going to have any. The consistent British response, even when the British limit Jewish immigration and when they limit land sale to Jews, their response is always firmly, there isn't going to be political representation and control of the country by the Arab population. It is British and remain British. And they don't give a timeline for their departure. They never do that.
Not until the late 30s with the Peel Commission and when things are spiraling out of control. Okay, the last point for tonight, because we ran out of time. When it comes to self-defense, the Jews decided that civilian control of the defense mechanisms is important. Now, every country that's not a military dictatorship or a junta understands that. In the United States, who's in charge of the army? The Secretary of Defense, who's a civilian. Civilian control of the... In Israel today, who's in charge of the army? The Minister of Defense, who's a civilian, who's beholden to the government, run by the Prime Minister. So there needs to be civilian control over the guys with the guns. Well, who's that going to be? The answer is that the Haganah becomes an arm of the Histadrut. The Histadrut, which is the Israel Labor Organization, is the most representative of all the Jewish organizations in the country, other than the big tent, Knesset Yisrael, which we'll talk about next time. And so the Haganah is supposed to be beholden to civilian authority of the Histadrut. This continues all the way until 1948. Who runs the army in the pre-state era? David Ben-Gurion. Why? Because civilian. Okay, we'll stop here.